I'm Dave Heller, and this is Newsworks Tonight. One of the most basic duties of government is to protect its citizens, yet sometimes the government fails so spectacularly in that charge that it endangers them instead. WHYY's Dana DeFilippo introduces us to a woman who still struggles to overcome her encounter with two Philadelphia police officers that put her in the sights of a rapist.
If you're drunk and police arrest you in Philadelphia, here's what they're supposed to do. Put you in jail until either you sober up or a friend or relative comes to get you. Here's what two cops did with Chris one summer night in 2011. They watched her walk off, barefoot and blackout drunk, in the dead of night into an unfamiliar high-crime neighborhood. There, someone kidnapped and raped her repeatedly. We're withholding her last name because she is a sexual assault victim. It was the worst night of her life.
I go through phases where I have really good weeks or months where it doesn't affect me as much, and then this is hard. And there's other times like now where it cripples me.
Chris later sued the city and won a $1.25 million settlement, the highest civil rights-related payout last year. A federal judge agreed with her attorney's claim that this was a case of state-created danger. To prove that claim, an attorney has to show that a cop acted in a shocking way, a way that made someone more vulnerable to danger than if the cop had done nothing at all. Such claims are fairly uncommon. The city paid more than $8 million last year to settle more than 100 civil rights complaints. Just a handful involved state-related danger claims. Still, when employees flout rules created to protect public safety, it can cost the government a fortune and ruin lives. Hans Minos, head of the citizen watchdog group the Police Advisory Commission, says that makes the government's response to rule-breaking employees critical.
I don't think the public or anybody expects perfection from anyone. But I think that when it comes from either whether it's a police force or your neighbor or your best friend or your mayor, if they err, they need to acknowledge it and say, yeah, we really messed up here. What we did here was not all right. And then obviously not stop there and put into place tangible things that you're going to do to fix it.
That didn't happen in Chris's case. The police who put her in the path of a rapist were never disciplined. The department never internally investigated the case. And rape investigators lost the evidence that was collected, so her rapes remain unsolved. Elizabeth Crawford was one of Chris's attorneys.
That's what made her have the most distrust in the system. Because I think, you know, you could sort of attribute the first action being two bad eggs, just two exceptions in the police department. But what happened afterwards and the failure to investigate this rape was more of a systemic problem.
Civil rights attorney Alan Yatvin has argued these sorts of claims before. He says the city's notorious inability to hold cops accountable for their bad behavior means that other measures, like retraining cops on existing policies, are even more important. Many rule-breaking Philadelphia cops dismissed by the department get their jobs back through arbitration.
They can't effectively discipline a police officer, even in the most blatant, got the cop on video, DNA, in the police car, whatever situation, they still can't seem to make discipline stick.
Yatvin says top brass has to make sure all officers follow the department protocols.
Put it in the officer's face. Make it clear. This won't be tolerated, and this is our rule. And, you know, say it over and over.
And if the police department doesn't do that?
Then they're going to keep writing checks. Bad things are going to happen to citizens. People are not going to be able to have confidence that the police force is learning lessons from its mistakes.
Chris was a single college student juggling classes with a full-time job when this happened to her. Since then, she has tried to block out the bad memories by creating new ones. She got married, she started a family, and she left Philadelphia last summer after she earned her college degree. But there's one thing she doesn't think will ever change, her fear of the police.
I honestly feel like I'm going to be sometimes that person who gets pulled over for speeding or something, and I just won't stop because I'm so afraid. I don't think I'll ever trust them, and it's something that I struggle with now, trying to think about how I'm going to teach my daughter to trust them and not fear them when I don't feel the same way.
Dana DeFilippo, WHYY News.
A federal jury in Philadelphia has convicted Mohamed Jabateh for lying on asylum documents about his involvement in mass atrocities in Liberia. The jury convicted the Delaware County man of fraud and perjury after just one day of deliberations. More from WHYY's Bobby Allen.
To some observers, it was kind of like getting Al Capone on tax evasion. Mohamed Jabateh was a rebel commander during Liberia's first civil war in the 1990s. He pillaged rural villages and directed mass murder, and he never got in trouble. Then he lied about it to U.S. immigration officials, who didn't catch him at the time. 20 years later, they did, and prosecuted him.
We think that these crimes were heinous, and we think that the jury verdict supported that, that they can't seek safe haven here in the United States.
That's one of the lead federal prosecutors on the case, Linwood Wright.
Well, we're hopeful that there are Liberians who will feel a sense of justice, but that wasn't one of our considerations.
Wright says his focus was on proving that Jabateh lied on his paperwork. That did require showing that he was involved in massacres during Liberia's first civil war, even if he wasn't technically on trial for war crimes. To Elaine Werner, it doesn't matter. He's an international human rights lawyer with Civitas Maxima, which has worked with hundreds of Liberian war victims. Werner says it's the first time ever someone was convicted of a crime connected to the first civil war in Liberia.
So really, today is a very significant day for justice in Liberia, and this conviction is a very, very big importance.
Werner says in the absence of Liberian authorities holding anyone responsible, prosecutors in the U.S. and European countries with large Liberian communities are increasingly going after war criminals from that country's old conflicts. The years-long investigation here included 5 trips to Liberia to interview villagers, then flying more than a dozen of them to the courthouse in Philadelphia to be witnesses in the trial. Again, Wright.
This was a difficult matter for a couple of reasons. One of them is that it happened, the crimes that happened over there, the evidence was from 20 years ago. That poses its own unique issues.
Jabateh, meanwhile, is in federal custody awaiting his sentencing date next year. Immigration officials say when his prison term is up, 51-year-old Jabateh will be deported back to Liberia. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
The actions and omissions of the current administration are prompting explorations of the limits of the executive branch. Presidential power from Nixon to now, appointments, scandals, and stories from the White House is the title of a legal education seminar hosted by the Pennsylvania Bar Institute tomorrow in Philadelphia. Holding forth on the topic are 2 speakers with extensive experience and insight: John Dean, White House counsel for then-President Richard Nixon, and Jim Robinault, a partner and former chair of the Business Litigation Group at Thompson Hine LLP's Cleveland office, and presidential historian who's authored 3 nonfiction books, including January 1973, Watergate, Roe v. Wade, Vietnam, and The Month That Changed America Forever. John Dean, Jim Robinault, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
As this is in part an historical account, how was it decided to start with the Nixon administration?
Yeah, well, you know, everybody today, you can't turn on the television or the radio without hearing comparisons between Nixon and Trump, and we see a lot of similarities between the two of them in personality traits. We also see huge differences. So, you know, everybody wants to look back in history and try to predict what's going to happen in the future, and I think that's why a lot of people have a high interest in this program.
Well, we're also talking to lawyers, and if anybody ever had a difficult client, I did. So we're trying to share what we learned from that experience, because the Nixon administration, we wrote the book of what not to do.
What role do lawyers play in holding the executive powers in check?
Well, they have a big role. Of course, as we've seen it already with the Trump administration, how the courts have trimmed his sail on trying to impose executive orders for travel bans on foreign countries. So the checks and balances are working, and you'll generally find a lawyer somehow involved in that check and balance process.
How about the interplay between the three branches of government and specifically the legislature, who it's perceived over the years has ceded more and more authority to the president, particularly on foreign affairs and war powers?
The big problem has been in the last 20 years that the commander-in-chief authority out of Article 2 has just wildly expanded, and especially after terrorists attacked us here in the United States. You know, we went as far as authorizing torture, and that in that instance, that's the commander-in-chief power that's being used. Congress did not stand up to that the way they should have. So in foreign affairs, you really do want the president to be dominant. You want the legislature to be a check. But it just so happens that when you face a situation like we have in, after 9/11, people give a lot more leeway to a president doing things when they think that that president is protecting them.
Given what some perceive as Donald Trump's volatility, there's now a call to put some checks in play regarding his ability to put his finger on the nuclear trigger.
Well, you know, I did a tweet the other day, and I had thought about that problem. And it wasn't just Trump's arrival that made me think about it. I think all presidents should be subject to some check on nuclear power. Theoretically, when the power was delegated to the president, it was something that Truman just assumed as a part of his war powers and being the first president to release nuclear weapons. And it sort of stayed there. The Congress in its war powers legislation really didn't wrestle with the problem, and it needs to be addressed. It's such a monumental decision to use that type of weaponry that it really should be carefully considered. Now, if we're in the situation where missiles are headed towards us, that might be a circumstance where the Congress would want to write an exception. But I think otherwise, they have the war-making power. And it's been whittled away after major wars, after minor wars, after significant wars. And it's something that I think the founders wisely spread amongst the representatives of the people. And it's not there today.
History is an ebb and flow. What do you see ahead for America?
Well, I think that what we're going to face here in the next 2 years is the question of whether or not we're going to move to autocratic rule or we're going to get back to democratic rule. There is a real push right now to move in the direction of an autocracy, and that's not just in politics. You know, money is controlling politics right now, and I think the American people need to take a close look at how money is influencing politics, and perhaps even change the Constitution in that regard, because you just simply cannot have a few people out of this country deciding what the politics are going to be, and we've got to get back to being a true democracy.
Hope your talk goes well tomorrow. Thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you, Dave. Appreciate the interview.
Jim Robinault, partner and former chair of the Business Litigation Group at Thompson Hine LLP's Cleveland office, and John Dean, White House counsel for then-President Richard Nixon. The comedy Buyer and Seller, now running in Center City, Philadelphia, in a staging by 1812 Productions, mostly takes place in a basement, though not just any basement. WHYY's Howard Shapiro explains in this review.
The very funny one-man play Buyer and Seller, that's C-E-L-L-A-R, is about a down-on-his-heels actor who takes a job minding the private shopping mall Barbara Streisand has in a basement of her Malibu compound. I know, it sounds like pure fiction. In fact, Barbara Streisand did put a mall in her basement with little shops that contain her collections of dolls, dresses, stage and movie costumes, and, you know, the sorts of things you acquire when you're a ginormous star. She got the idea after visiting Winterthur, the celebrated Delaware museum that's an ode to Americana. That visit also inspired Streisand to write and take all the pictures for her coffee table book called My Passion for Design, in which she tours you through the collections in her mall. And that book inspired playwright Jonathan Tollens to create Buyer and Seller, a recent hit off Broadway. Here at 1812 Productions, Dido von Reigersberg plays the part of the man hired to manage the mall, plus every other character, including Barbara. Van Reigersberg, highly visible in Philly as his alter ego, the cabaret drag queen Martha Graham Cracker, is terrific in the 90-minute show, never imitating Streisand, but channeling her with only a slight change in the pitch of his voice, a teeny bit of Brooklynese, and his ample acting talent. Here he is, greeting his boss at the mall after she returns from her book tour.
Welcome home. How was the book tour? Fine, if you like other people. I'd just rather be at home in my pajamas, eating and trading stocks online. And the whole time I was gone, I kept thinking of things that I could do down here with you. Come, let's go to the dress shop.
Everything you hear from the stage is fiction, except for the fact of Streisand's basement-level mall. The production zips by in Van Reigersberg's telling and under the direction of Dan O'Neill. Still, after spending an evening listening to made-up dialogue between Babs and her hired hand, you can't help but thinking of her the way the playwright paints her. Cautious, vulnerable, sometimes domineering, and sometimes clueless. At one point, she asks the mall manager to take off his shoes when entering the main part of her house. Oh, like in the airport, he says. What do you mean, she says. That may sound about right. In the end, Barbara Streisand is buyer and seller's springboard to a plot that, in a very funny way, explores stellar fame and its inevitable road to isolation. It's at Plays and Players Theater through October 29th. I'm Howard Shapiro for WHYY.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Find us on iTunes or listen back at whyy.org/news. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.